My name is Bobby McGill. I'm a science writer for Climate Central in New York. We're to talk today about climate communication. Children born today will see in their lifetimes dramatic change because of global warming. They'll live in a future that no longer looks like the past. But even as more and more people recognize the threat, public understanding of the urgency of climate change remains low. Sometimes they think they're too powerless to make a difference, so they tune it out, not knowing how to act. Sometimes the public doesn't grasp the urgency because some of the news they receive about climate change is simply wrong. Why is it that people still fail to grasp the urgency of global warming? And what role do journalists play in that lack of understanding? How can the media more effectively communicate the complexities of climate change, sparking our audience's interest in climate change while cutting through all the muck? We'll try to answer some of those questions today. We have three panelists. One of them is late. He'll be here in a few minutes. To my right, I have Emmanuel Vincent. He's a scientist at the Sierra Nevada Research Institute at the University of California, Merced. He leads the Climate Feedback Project at UC Merced, which rates the scientific credibility of news stories about climate science. So far, mostly climate change stories appearing in Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, and a few other outlets. And to his right is Patrick Gonzalez. He's the principal climate scientist at the National Park Service based at UC Berkeley. He's a forest ecologist and works with policymakers to integrate science into policy. He'll talk about how the National Park Service talks to the public about climate change. And in a few minutes, John Krosnick will be joining us. He is a humanities and social science professor at the director of Stanford University's Political Psychology Research Group. An expert on questionnaire design and survey research methods, John has conducted extensive research into public opinion about climate change and can tell us more about why people think what they think about global warming. So we'll start with Emmanuel.
Thanks for the introduction. Okay, so I'm Emmanuel Vincent. I'm a scientist. I got my PhD in France on hurricanes and climate, so really science. And then I moved to the US to do a postdoc at MIT, also science, climate science. And that's when I realized that something was wrong. And in my opinion, in the news, I started reading these things that were inconsistent with what these scientists know. So I thought, what would be the best way to try and do something as scientists to improve that?
The American public reacts to real information like that. And when they say, wow, warmest year on record? I guess that is a diagnostic about warming, isn't it? that's the type of life we live in, where people actually react to the data. The percent of people who, when we asked them, said warming has probably been happening or will happen in the future if nothing is done to stop it. These are gigantic numbers. This is the percent of Americans, when we asked them about the cause of warming, who said they thought humans had been at least partly responsible, if not primarily responsible. Again, gigantic numbers. And you'll see there is no obvious trend here. There's no trend downwards. There's no trend upwards. And if you are paying attention to public discussion, you'll know about this work, namely Oreskes' book on the left and the movie that was made about it, called The Merchants of Doubt. The assertion being made there is, through you, the American public has been manipulated, just as they were in thinking about tobacco. The assertion made here is that there's been a delay in the implementation of any greenhouse gas restriction legislation because the fossil fuel industry has succeeded in creating uncertainty about this issue. Is it true that the fossil fuel industry has been creating uncertainty about this issue? Well, the answer is, this is just one way to look at answers to a question about certainty. We ask people, how sure are you about your answer to the warming question? And the important thing to look at here is, over a period from 1997 to 2015, there is no decline in the percent of people who are extremely or very sure. And the same is true if you look at the rest of the 5-point rating scale. The claims that the American public have been led to become uncertain, it's just not the case. So, let me stop there in terms of the data, and let me talk a little bit about, just since I have only 2 minutes left, the final couple points I'll put out before we get into questions hopefully later. So if I were to show you the next 2 hours of slides that are on this laptop, to walk you through all the survey data that we have and the data that will be available on this new website, what you would see is not only is the American public accepting the basics of the natural sciences on climate as you have portrayed. But they are also very supportive of government action in huge numbers. And there are an array of policies that people like a lot for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and there are an array of policies they don't like at all. The policies they like are the ones that guarantee emissions reduction. They are what some policymakers call mandates. So they are restrictions of the amount of emissions that can be put out. What people don't like, or say, are principles that they come from lots of economics research over many decades, but that assume if you increase prices, people will emit less. If you put a tax on carbon, people will emit less. All those kinds of things are plausible if you've taken economics courses and you believe that they will apply here and the policies will be calibrated properly and so on. But what Americans like the most are policies that say, I guarantee you an emissions reduction. Not, you'll probably have one. And I can't tell you how big it's going to be because it's the free market that's going to do it. So this is not me speaking. This is the American public speaking. The evidence as you walk through the data. The last thing I'm going to say about the survey data is one of the claims that's often made is that Americans either don't prioritize this issue, they think it's distant in the future, won't affect them, doesn't matter that much. That's not true according to these data. In fact, Americans, 75% of Americans want the current government in Washington to be devoting substantial effort to the problems that will face the world in the future, and they rank climate change as the number one problem that will face the world in the future. So it is not the case that people don't prioritize, and it's also not the case that people are unwilling to pay. We have used very well-established methods for measuring the public's willingness to pay to reduce emissions in the future, and what we find is that the amount of money people say they're willing to pay, remarkably, is about equal to what the EPA estimated it would actually cost to create an 80% reduction in emissions over a period of 50 years. So let me stop there with that evidence. My final remark would be, okay, fine. So if the public is so overwhelmingly on the side of this issue, why has Congress not done anything? And I can tell you two suspicions I have. And here, I'm now stopping what I'm telling you based on evidence, and now I'm willing to speculate, but I want you to know there's speculation. The first speculation is, I think Congress doesn't know what I just told you. And the reason I think Congress doesn't know what I just told you is because there are lots of polls out there being done by lots of different organizations with varying quality and varying question wording that are sometimes being misinterpreted. And so if I were a non-survey expert consumer looking at a graph of the dots of points that come out of surveys over time, I would see a lot of variability. And I would start to wonder, is there anything real here that I should pay any attention to at all? Should I pay more attention to the phone calls and letters and emails I get from my constituents than to these supposedly scientific polls? So that's one concern that I have. And in fact, when we have asked Americans here in the data, when we've asked Americans to guess what percent of Americans answer each of these questions the way I just showed you, the American public doesn't know. The American public is 75% on the green side of the issue, we might say, whereas they think the country is divided 50-50. Why wouldn't it also be the case that Congress would think the American public is divided 50-50? So that's one potential explanation.
So none of us.
The difference between scientific surveys with unbiased question wording versus surveys that are not. Now you may say, look, we're the society of environmental journalists. We're not the society of polling journalists. And that's fine. But there is no society of polling journalists. It may be helpful for you to think about how this could fit into your beat and to help the country get in touch with the realities itself. But the second obvious issue here is that public opinion is not the only force that drives policymaking in Washington. And certainly, with natural science, we know, is not the only force that drives policymaking in Washington. It's not the case that the National Academy of Science has put out a report on natural science and then immediately Congress says, okay, well, we gotta take action. There are lots of other factors that influence policymaking besides public opinion. I'm a political scientist. I'm an expert only in the public opinion side of it. But if you want to understand why there's no action and you want to think about what you can do, I would advise don't think about what you can do to change public thinking. Public thinking is already overwhelmingly on the green side, already unprecedented on the green side. When people say, oh, if only people understood the local impact it's going to have, or if only people could understand the dramatic impact like Hurricane Katrina is going to have, they already get all this. They can tell the difference between Hurricane Katrina and 100 years of warming. The vast majority of people don't need to read another story about another natural science finding in order to say, oh, okay, really? The Earth has been warming? I didn't know that. That's not what's going on here. There are other forces that are at work. So if your interest is in convincing Americans about the natural science, that battle's been won already. If your interest is in disseminating new scientific findings, that's fine, but it's a drop in a big ocean of information people have. It's not going to have big changes resulting in the kinds of data that I collect. So you might want to think about what are the goals of that you can pursue that would be constructive. And with that, I will stop. Thank you.
Thank you, John. So we have about a half an hour left, so I'm going to turn it over to Q&A, and don't forget that Blue Tags, SCJ members, active members have priority in questioning, so we're going to start over here. Let's see, you right here.
Hi. I had a question for Professor Stanford. I'm sorry.
John.
My notes there for your name. Apologize. Your data. Sorry. Okay. Thank you. I know. But your data, I wonder, can you break it down by age group? Because I thought we might get to younger people and how we would communicate to them. My understanding as a professor is that they know about these things, but they don't want to hear about it, or they only are drawn toward the headlines that are interesting and sexy and entertaining. And so I wasn't sure how we get to those people that they know about solutions and what to do.
So, okay, there were a lot of parts to that question, you added one at the end there. So let me say, number one, they already get it. They're, in fact, the younger adults are more concerned, more endorsing, less divided than older adults are. So there's no battle to be won uniquely with that group to convince them of something or to make them aware of something. As you may know, on many environmental issues, younger adults are more concerned. I'm not talking about 11-year-olds here because we don't survey 11-year-olds. We only go down to 18-year-olds. But among, 18 to 25-year-olds are more aware, more concerned than older people by a small margin, not a large margin. So none of what I said would differ for that group.
All right. Right here. Raise your hands. Go ahead. I'm sorry. You on the left.
What color shirt? Go what ahead. Color shirt?
I'm just curious.
No, thank you. The demographics of the respondents in the surveys. Okay, so let me answer this way. We do random sampling for our surveys. All of the surveys that I've described to you come from what's called random digit dialing telephone interviews. So these are interviews of people on landlines and cell phones, and we literally generate, we've got every area code in the country, every central office code, which is the next three digits, and then we generate lots and lots and lots of sets of four random digits after that, and we call all those numbers to reach as many people as we can. This methodology continues to produce highly accurate results in comparisons with benchmarks. So, for example, in 2012, the final pre-election poll result was, 52-46, Obama-Romney, and the results from the on election day were almost exactly that, about one percentage point off. And that's only elections. If we measure how many people have a passport or how many people have a driver's license or how many bedrooms are in people's homes that are measured by the Census Bureau, this methodology produces highly accurate results. The answer to your question then is, not surprisingly, the demographics in these samples resemble the country almost exactly. So they're 55% women, 45% men. There's a distribution of age, there's a distribution of education, and so on. These resemble extremely closely the distributions that are documented in the census and in the Census Bureau surveys. The small discrepancies that occur, we tend to be a little bit short on racial minorities. We tend to be a little bit short on less educated people. We tend to be a little bit short on low-income people. Those discrepancies are corrected by what's called statistical weighting, W-E-I-G-H-T-I-N-G, because we know what the truth of those distributions are, and that enhances the accuracy of other measurements in the survey a little bit. Did I get the point of your question? Thank you.
Emmanuel, I just want to ask you just a little bit about climate feedback. What sort of feedback have you received from other journalists about your reviews of their work?
So I think one of the feedback we receive, every time we produce a review, then we inform the editor or the journalist as appropriate. When it's a guest, we inform the editor. And the feedback we have is usually when there is a positive review, so the scientists agree with the writing. Usually the reporter is happy about that, usually tweets that and say, look, scientists find my work is of good quality. So that's one of the feedback. I think sometimes they are curious and a little bit, I don't think people really like it. They are like, oh, well, what is that? Someone is commenting on my work again. I mean, so I guess that's a little bit of suspicion. And some feedback that we receive is also no response. I mean, like, for instance, when we contact the Wall Street Journal, there is just nothing coming back. When we contacted the editor at Forbes, I think he was more listening to what we say, and the feedback was more to say kind of nothing, like just say, what do you want? And I think the response was probably not explicit, but I guess what we see already is that in Forbes, the coverage is kind of shifting, so maybe we are also having an influence.
Mm-hmm. With reporting that rises above the white noise and encourages people to pay attention.
Please repeat the question before you respond, if you would.
The gentleman from Forbes was asking how the U.S. National Parks could respond to a part of the session description to help climate change rise above the white noise of other coverage and
encourage people to pay attention.
And I've tried to do exactly that, provide you with some of the most visible and meaningful and scientifically credible examples. And that is my answer to you. The national parks, people love them. Across all demographics and political affiliations, and the melting glaciers in Alaska and Glacier National Park, the bleaching of corals in National Park of American Samoa, the dying trees in Rocky and in Sequoia and in Yosemite, the rising sea level at Golden Gate and in Everglades. These are scientifically documented, attributed to human climate change, and that place-based type of reporting among the different types of reporting that you do can engage people in the local area, of course, and we have so many visitors from across the country and around the world to U.S. national parks. So I think that the importance of the national parks provides that next level that could raise people's interests. And my recommendations were to do that in a scientifically credible way, so it's really solid.
I'd just like to ask you about messenger credibility. The National Park Service is a government agency, so there's inherently a level of skepticism among some members of the population. But people can also go to national parks. They see and they can see the melting glaciers and they can touch the dead trees, right? But I'm curious if you think that gives the National Park Service a level of credibility about as a messenger of climate science, either greater or less than the credibility that we might have as reporters in public opinion.
Well, to my knowledge, actually, the Park Service has commissioned public opinion surveys, scientific surveys about the credibility of the interpreters, and they're very, very highly regarded. In terms of climate change specifically, though, the National Park Service is neither a foremost authority on it, nor recognized as such. However, since I was hired 6 years ago, I've been trying to provide that solid scientific foundation to ensure that our interpreters have the best science, and so that credibility that is in other areas of natural history can extend to this important area. And it's actually one third of my job. Just last week, I gave a training session to our interpreters, presenting a lot of what I showed you in 10 minutes.
John, maybe you could speak to that as well. Who does your research show is the most credible messenger on climate science?
That's a question that's often asked directly in surveys. Who do you believe the most? And I think it's naive to look at answers to that question, because there, you say professors or government officials or news reporters. Well, as you all know, that none of those groups is monolithic. There are differences in perceived credibility of different sources within those categories. And so I would, number one, first of all, encourage you not to pay any attention to the answers to survey questions that ask that. Secondly, if what you're interested in is understanding, who should you quote in stories, how credible are you in the eyes of those who read and hear and listen to your work, the answer is that it's going to be heterogeneous. There's not going to be a single source. For any one of you, whoever you write for, will be trusted by some people and not by others. What matters for the American public, though, is not a single story or a single message coming from a single source, but it's when there is convergence and consensus from many different sources. And so the key here is not necessarily to worry about the details of any one contribution to the discussion, but to recognize that in a coordinated effort, this room can make a huge difference, even if your individual source is only exposed to one subset of readers or viewers or listeners.
Sure.
Robin. Sure.
Yeah. So we do evaluate. Oh yeah. So regarding the Wall Street Journal, did we find a difference between the opinion section and the news reporting? So I must say we review everything, because sometimes I think that's a technique that is used. Unsupported opinion are put in the opinion section, but from a scientific point of view, it's not an opinion. It's factual statement that can be accurate or not. So we evaluate everything. And it's true that it turns out that what we see is that it's in the opinion sections that we find the most inaccurate things, because they are guests. And I think it's less attached to the image of the newspaper. But in the eyes of the reader, I think they don't make a difference. When you see Forbes contributor or Forbes staff, you just read the thing and you say it's in Forbes, and then you share that on social media. So I don't think we should make too much of a difference.
Yeah, very timely question.
Why don't we have 75%
So the question is, if 75% of Americans are on what I'll call the green side of the issue, why is anybody in Congress now who is not on that side of the issue? And the answer is the following, that when we as political scientists have studied voting over a period of 50 years, what we've come to recognize is that any one issue, whether it's climate change or gun control or education or terrorism, might seem to be a huge issue for the nation, but it becomes a focus of passion for only a small subset of Americans. Each issue attracts its own little public. We call them the issue public. So there's the abortion issue public, there's the gun control issue public, and there's the climate change issue public. These are typically about 10% of Americans, plus or minus, who wake up every day, look across the pillow, smile, and say, "Good morning, abortion. Another day, another opportunity for me to do something about you." So they live for this issue. 90% of Americans don't. And it's that 10% plus or minus who vote based on the issue. We have now in press a new article that's going to appear, in a month or two, that shows eight different studies using eight different scientific methods, different data sets, different years, all showing over and over again that climate change opinions do shape voting decisions of the people who are passionate about that issue, just as this literature would suggest. And so what really that means is that, for example, somebody named Inhofe might get elected over and over again in Oklahoma, despite the fact that the majority of Oklahomans don't accept what he might consider the most important policy position he takes on any issue, that being on climate, because they vote mostly based on other issues. Yeah, so can I interrupt? Why don't I answer your larger question, which is differences between others polling and ours, because there are lots of them. So I'll answer in a broad way. So the first thing is, for those who didn't, so the question is in two parts. Number one, could I comment on polling by other organizations that looks different from the polling that we've done? And number two, you've mentioned a specific result from Pew, which is 41% of people saying climate change is affecting people now, I think you said. Okay, so 41, that's a lot less than 75. How can that be? So the first thing that's critical here is you have to look at the wording of the question. That I didn't tell you about the wordings of a question about how whether people are being affected now. And you might assume, as many people have over a period of decades, that unless people are being affected by a problem now, they're not going to be concerned about it. They're not going to want any effort to be put into it. That's wrong. Americans think big, and we have lots of evidence that Americans want their government to address problems that don't affect them personally or don't even affect the majority of people now. For example, when unemployment goes up in America, the news media get very worked up when it goes above 10%. That's a huge threshold. That means 90% of people still have a job. But when it goes above 10%, not only do the media get worked up, but the public gets worked up. And it's not because of the unemployed people who are getting worked up. Lots and lots of people who have jobs also think it's bad when unemployment goes up in the country. People think bigger than their own personal pocketbooks, their own personal front yards, and so on. So, first of all, that's not really a discrepancy, because I haven't told you about questions we've asked about whether people see people being affected in problematic ways. And I'm not sure we've ever asked exactly that question. But if you want to then look at, which I would love for you to do, our survey results versus those of other organizations critically, I would encourage you, whenever you find a discrepancy, think about two things. Number one, is the wording the same? And I understand that I obsess about wording in a way that you might not. And so you might say, well, they look basically the same. And unless you read my 1,500-page book called The Handbook of Questionnaire Design, you won't necessarily know about all the details of how a bias can be built into a question in a subtle way without you necessarily realizing it. I'm very committed to not asking biased questions. And you may see what looks like comparable questions that aren't. I'll give you an example. Pew Research Center, instead of our question, which I showed you earlier, we say, do you think the Earth's temperature probably has been going up over the past 100 years, or do you think it probably hasn't been happening? Pew says, do you think there is solid evidence that the world's temperature has been going up over the last few decades or not? Now, you might say, basically the same question. But it's importantly different in a few ways. Number one, it's not asking for their personal opinion about whether they think warming has been going up or not. It's a question about their awareness of evidence. Secondly, it's a high bar, solid evidence, as opposed to you think it's probably been happening or probably hasn't been happening. Third, it's a different time period. As it turns out, they get lower numbers than we do. When we do an experiment where we randomly assign our respondents either to get our wording or their wording, we reproduce their number just as we can reproduce our own number. It's about the wording. So you have to decide which of those wordings are you interested in? Which ones do you learn from? Maybe you would say both. That's fine. You know. So in other words, it might be the case that a smaller percentage of people think there's solid evidence for the last few decades than think it probably has been happening over 100 years. Lots of people can reach conclusions on the basis of their own backyard and their gardening, for example, rather than solid scientific evidence. So that's one issue. Secondly, and this, I'm sorry, is a harder problem, that in addition to the wording, you have to pay attention to how the data were collected. How was the sample drawn, and how was the interviewing done? And unfortunately, the problem is the internet, and you got to just forgive me, I'm going to be a little blunt here. The internet has created a cadre of heroin dealers who are selling crappy survey data and making a huge amount of money from it. And unfortunately, news organizations have been shifting more and more in the direction of undifferentiatedly disseminating those non-scientific surveys. Right on my computer right now is a kind of worked up discussion among survey professionals today about the fact that the New York Times published one of these non-scientific surveys without saying it was non-scientific. And our professional standards say you got to at least disclose the methodology. There are professionals at the New York Times who are committed to high-quality scientific surveys only being disseminated. They are unhappy with the people at the New York Times who disseminated this survey without acknowledging the non-scientific method. You guys care about science. I care about science. And so in this case, I would just encourage you to care about science when it comes to polling. If it's an internet survey, it's almost certainly not done with a random sample of Americans. And that means put it in a little ball and in a garbage can and don't think more about it. Because there's no scientific basis, none, to say because we interviewed 1,000 people or 2,000 people or 5,000 people or half men, half women, anything else. There's no scientific basis for generalizing from those results to the country. So that's the first thing. Secondly, how the sample is drawn is only a piece of the methodology. I will tell you, the pre-election polls done regarding Brexit were all over the place in the UK, from stay winning by 10 to stay losing by 10. There were dozens and dozens of these polls in the weeks prior to the election. Not one was done with scientific random sampling. So there is no reason why those polls should have been accurate. So unfortunately, you as journalists have more work to do to be able to differentiate the surveys that are scientific from those that aren't. And I would encourage you, so just to wrap back to your question, Pew is a great organization. I have terrific regard for them, but they cut corners. For example, instead of randomly sampling an adult from the household when they reach the household, which is what we do and what should be done, they randomly sample from the adults who are home at the time that the call is completed. That saves money, it saves time, and it biases the sample toward people who are at home at the time that a call is made to a landline. And as a result, we've shown if we had not done our random sampling, if we only settled for people who were at home, we would get results that are different from the ones that we get. Costs more money, takes more time, but I'm committed to doing it. And that's a level of detail you may not have time to scrutinize. But I would just encourage that as worthwhile. Thank you.
All right, I want to get to two more questions. We've got about 5 more minutes. Go ahead.
So the question is, claims have been made that as we shift from a fossil fuel economy to an alternative energy economy, jobs will be lost in the fossil fuel sector. How does that play with the public? That was one component of an effort made by loud skeptical voices some years ago to convince the public, look, we're in an economic crisis following 2008. Now is not the time to do anything that will hurt the economy, and trying to go free of fossil fuels will hurt the economy. It will cause a loss of jobs. So we have been asking in our polls a series of questions over time about exactly this issue. We've asked, do you think that that if things are done to reduce climate change in the future, that unemployment will go up, go down, stay the same? Do you think the economy will be hurt, helped, or unchanged as a result? And what we find is only about 10% of Americans think addressing climate change will hurt the economy and increase jobs in America. The plurality of people actually believe doing this will help. And you can see how that's not necessarily a fantasy answer, in the sense that solar power companies are calling my house, every day trying to sell me more solar panels. There is a new economy emerging where you can see people getting jobs, making solar panels, selling and installing solar panels. It doesn't require much imagination for Americans to realize that if there are fewer people working on pipelines, maybe there will be more people making panels.
Next question. Go ahead.
Am I allowed to talk about this? This is there's nothing environmental about this question. Okay, so I'm going to make an environmental
briefly
question. Donald Trump did something that this new paper that we are releasing said was an absolutely bad idea for him to win. He expressed the most skeptical position on climate change he could have expressed. I was just flabbergasted when that happened, because our work has been known by Republicans for quite some time, Republicans involved in campaigns. I'm not saying that candidates shouldn't be honest with the public, but I am saying that this surprised me, because it was an event where Trump said something publicly that, according to lots of research, reduced rather than increased his chances of winning the general election. I have absolutely no doubt about that, and I'm happy to be public in saying that is a position he has taken, which I suspect very strongly will come up either on Monday, in Monday's debate, or in one of the subsequent debates. And Americans who may not have noticed this yet will be reminded of it. He is too much on record now, having said it, to be able to back off it in a credible way, as long as the press hold him to what he said in the past. And so the real question then becomes, how does that play out? And my prediction is I'm making a very comfortable one here. It'll play out just as this issue always has. This issue will help Hillary Clinton, and it will hurt Donald Trump. Does that mean that it will determine the outcome of the election? Absolutely not. There are many other factors that play in. There are many other issue publics who will be voting based on other issues. And my perception at the moment, although, as you may know, the statistical forecasters have Clinton's chances of victory at about 75% now. It was up at 90% a couple weeks ago. I think it all hinges on Monday. What happens at that debate will set the tone for the rest of this campaign. Either Trump will come off as presidential and policy in command of policy issues or not, and either Clinton will come off as a relaxed, accomplished politician in command of policy and unruffled by claims that are made about irrelevant issues, or not. And I think that will set the tone for where we move, and I have no confidence at all that I can predict what's going to happen on Monday.
Thank you, John. One last question. Are there any questions for Patrick and Emmanuel? Going. Go ahead. So that sounds like an argument for negative emissions. Go ahead.
And there was another session where two economists were pessimistic about the our ability to get to the lowest emission scenario that I presented there.
With
conservation, there was technology, solar technology. Oh. Okay, so that was the first point I was going to make, that it's not just conservation, it's a suite of different changes, including especially renewables and energy efficiency and conservation and keeping population within the medium variant of the UN, and leapfrogging polluting technologies in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. So it's a whole suite of practices, and I would say that the IPCC analyses, our analyses, do show that conservation is insufficient. Just as a final point, I would say, well, two final points. There's negative emissions, but two final things. One is because of the time lag between when we emit carbon to the atmosphere and when the atmosphere warms and then ecosystems respond, we are committed to a certain amount of heating due to past emissions, even if we went to zero today. And that amount of heating is about the same as the amount of heating that has already occurred, 0.8 degrees Celsius. So beyond that, it is possible. So 0.8 plus 0.8 is 1.6. It is scientifically possible, and the third volume of the IPCC, last IPCC report, provided a lot of mitigation solutions. Bobby mentioned negative emissions, and included in this suite of practices is forest conservation, reduced emissions from deforestation and tropical degradation, forestation and afforestation, and other ecosystem-based ways to naturally remove carbon from the atmosphere and store it in vegetation. So there it is, a suite of examples, a commitment that is still below the Paris target and within and limiting the most drastic impacts of climate change, and third, ecosystem-based ways of removing carbon from the atmosphere naturally.
Thank you very much. Thank you guys for coming.